Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
How much of that do you want to hear? Everybody that's listened to this show knows the opening music. It's Radio Mysterioso here for March 7th of 2010. And our guest today is Mike Cleland, who is somebody I met at the Laughlin conference a few years ago. And he's very quiet. And unless somebody's very pushy, sometimes I don't notice. And I hope you didn't, Mike, I hope you didn't think I'd ever been rude to you. Got a Mike. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, okay, good. Mike is, he's one of those people that, and I don't think he really wants any publicity too much, unless you do, Mike, that kind of sits there in the background, does his business, does his blog, his research, talks to people, and tries to get to, I suppose, some kind of answers about what goes on with the paranormal and particularly the UFO subject, and some sort of contact with other human, extra human intelligence, I guess you'd call it. He's got two blogs. He's also a working artist. If you want to check out Little Boing Marks, that's his art artwork site, and Hidden Experience, which is deals with the subject matter we're going to talk about mostly on this show tonight. Mike, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. It's he expressed a concern that we mic a cell phone to do the interviews, but it's the only way I can do it and be sure that I'm going to get a good connection and that I don't have to pay any extra for it. I mean, it's part of my phone agreement, I guess.
And you juice it up well beforehand?
No, I just plug it in so I don't have to have to worry
about
it.
Yeah. My phone is plugged into the wall. I'm actually using an old-fashioned phone with a cord on it that has better sound quality than my other phone.
So you're a pro already. A couple shows that I've been on, they called me up beforehand and said, could you please use a landline phone? Cell phones don't work real well.
Yes.
We were going to have Mike on last week, but we would have had to call him on the road on a cell phone. And for one thing, I didn't know how reliable that would be, and for the other thing, I was gone all day, so I didn't know what his status was. So I have go ahead.
Yeah, I would have been somewhere on the interstate between Las Vegas and Idaho.
On the 15?
Coming back from the Laughlin conference. That's a week ago tonight.
Yeah, that's right. That's another route. Yeah, that's the.
Oh, was I-15? Yes, I-15.
Was it 15? Oh, okay. Yeah, because that one goes through Vegas and then straight up through that giant, impressive canyon, which you probably couldn't see if you were traveling at night on the Utah border.
The Virgin River Canyon.
Yeah. I wonder if it's – I bet it's got a raging river in it right now, because every time I've gone through there, it's been a tiny little trickle.
Yeah, springtime is actually – I think there's dams up – well, no, it feeds into Lake Mead, so I don't know where the dams are. That's one of the few undammed ones out west here.
Yeah, one of the few left. That's another thing I want to talk about later. I sent myself a bunch of questions to ask you, but I have to log into the questions. But I do remember my first one. You've got that site. Oh, also Walter is here, my friend Walter. You've heard Walter before.
I think we may have met. You were there at the Laughlin conference at one point?
Well, I've been there Excuse me. I've been there. I was there in 07 because my author, Sesheri, was speaking. I had long hair below my shoulders then. And then I was just there again last year. I came over because my friend Joseph Farrell was speaking. So we might have run into each other there.
I think we actually did meet. Because Joe Farrell, I remember he was sitting there at the table. So, yes, and you were there with Greg.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, I think I've been there three times, actually, and every time with Greg.
Good. And then we actually met. I can barely remember you, but I think we shook hands and said hello. Hello again.
Hello again.
Yeah, that was one of the things we were going to – that's why Mike was going to be on last week, because we were going to talk about the Laughlin Conference. I was going to go up to probably the last two or three days. I decided there really wasn't anybody there that I wanted to see speak. And besides Mike, there was nobody that I knew that was going that I really wanted to see, because the way I've got feel about these conferences now is I basically go there to hang out with people that I wouldn't normally get to see. And Mike's one, but you go to a lot of conferences, don't you?
I've gotten in a weird headspace in the last couple of years where I've gone to a bunch. I don't know, a lot. I guess, you know, more than one or two is a lot. But yeah, and I have sort of the same experience going to the conference. I was, you know, I kind of almost don't pay attention too much to the speakers. I feel like I'm so immersed in this stuff that I've heard their stuff or read their stuff, and so there's almost very little new, you know, sitting in a chair watching someone on a stage talk. Isn't as interesting as kind of, you know, milling around and talking to folks one-on-one.
That's for sure.
Yeah, that's the other reason I go to those conferences. There might be what I was saying about wanting to see somebody speak. If there's a guest there who I've read their stuff or heard about them or heard an interview, I've got a good chance, if I go to one of these things like you do or Walter does or anybody, of just walking up to them and talking to them for a little while.
I've learned to become pretty shameless about that, as far as just, like, you know, having that chance to walk up and talk to folks. Oftentimes you don't have a long conversation with them, but, you know, it's enough to, I feel like you can get a pretty good impression of folks.
Well, you have to be shameless in a lot of situations, because otherwise there's usually a lot of people wanting to talk to certain people, and so you have to kind of squeeze your way in or look for a moment when they're not otherwise occupied or doing, you know, not walking up to somebody at lunch or something unless they're by themselves, which I've done too. I did that with Robert Dean once, strangely enough. So you went to LOP. Why did you go? Because you wanted to talk to some of these people?
You know, actually, I've been there 2 years in a row. I've been there in 08, 09. And in 08, I met I met a woman named Natasha, and she was from Germany. We got along great, and we actually have quite a marvelous friendship, and we talk on Skype all the time. And she was planning to come. I wasn't actually planning to go to the this year's conference. And she Skyped me from Germany and said she was going to go, and it would be a great chance to see her. So I went down. You know, the big reason was mostly just to hang out and spend time with her. And it was great, and it was actually very interesting because she has a nice way of talking with folks, and so I could sort of, I don't want to say ride on her coattails, but she was very good at engaging folks, and I met a lot of folks that I don't think I would have spent any time with because of her.
Yeah, there's this argument I've seen that the UFO conference is kind of on its way out because people can get all the information they need if they have an internet connection. But the point of a lot of these things, whether you like the people there or not or whatever, is you get you can get a lot more information than personal contact. Well, you can't get any on the internet.
Sense of communities.
As Walter says, a sense of community by actually showing up there, sitting down and talking with people. So what a wonderful old-fashioned thing to do. Did you attend any of the lectures, actually?
The actual presentations?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean by lectures?
The presentations. I'm sorry.
Room?
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I attended a bunch of them. Not all of them, but most of them, actually. Some of them were quite good and quite informative, and I enjoyed them.
Example?
Yeah, I did a lot of that, yeah. And I also, we can go ahead and ask whatever you need to ask.
Oh, no, I said, are there any examples of some somebody's presentation that kind of stuck with you that you want to talk? But basically what we were asking with Mike last week when I was emailing with him back and forth was, can you give us kind of a report of what you saw there and what you thought was important? And because I think we kind of have the same ideas about a lot of things, even though we come from sort of different areas. And it'd be interesting to hear somebody that I knew was smart and knew what was going on and was inquiring still about the subject matter, what you thought was important there or what struck you, or if it was even, you know, if the conferences should still go on, if it's even worth it, et cetera. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, well, here, I'll just, I got the little booklet they hand you. I'm just sitting in my lap right now. Let me just leaf through here. The Rich Dolan spoke, which is always good. He's a great presenter, and he's got a nice way of filling up his 90 minutes, and that was great. So he was awesome. And Larry Warren was there. Michael Horn was supposed to be there and speak, and you know, whatever fortuitous events, he couldn't make it. I have no idea why. I wasn't complaining at all. But Larry Warren spoke, and that was great. That was really great. And he spoke along with a British police officer, a British detective named Gary Heseltine, who had been doing a bunch of research into British police. He had made his own presentation, which was a little dry and very dry PowerPoint. I think that most of the people in the audience had sort of moved beyond, you know, the information he was giving. You know, he had a lot of stories of, you know, and then a police officer saw a green light in the sky, and it was silent. You know, and then he would go on to the next case that some police officer had seen. But he's been doing research into the Rendlesham story. And it's very interesting because he has a very similar history to, he worked on a very similar base when he was in the Army.
Right.
Or actually the Air Force, the British Air Force, the Royal Air Force. So him and Larry Warren were actually kind of pals, and it was a great presentation. And also Travis Walton spoke, and I'd never seen him speak before. His story is such a mainstay of the UFO literature. It was great to see him stand up and give a talk. He's a very genuine and believable guy, and very very much I live out west now, and very much like a Western hardworking guy, just a very normal fellow. And the fact that this normal, soft-spoken fellow has been thrust into this limelight and is speaking so eloquently and so heartfelt about his story was really impressive. So,
yeah, he was at Roswell in '97, and I saw him there and talked to him a bit. And then he was at this little conference that was in L.A. one year, and it might have been the National UFO Conference that was not the Lisa Davis one, but another one. There were about four people speaking there, or five, not very many. And I guess most people there knew about his story. But what I found sort of irritating about it is that what he chose to talk about was how he couldn't believe that nobody would believe him, and that he'd been fighting with people that didn't believe his story for years and years, which sucked. But that's what his whole presentation was these people all say I'm lying, and here's why I'm not lying. Is that what he talked about this time?
There was a little bit of that in there, but that wasn't the overriding thing. He talked a little bit about the media circus and what a whirlwind it was.
Yeah.
And how he felt like he was forced into the limelight because the events of his case, he was missing, if I'm not mistaken, for 5 full days.
Yeah.
And then in those 5 days, news got out that he, that the UFO and the people who were part of the 7 other people in the truck had, in essence, told the police that it was a UFO abduction or some sort of event that involved a UFO. So there was this, crazy media circus that met him when he came out of the wherever when he reappeared. So he talked a little bit more just about what a oppressive media circus that was. But then he just basically talked about the case. So yeah, less so of that, but that certainly was an element of it.
Yeah, well, that might be more important to somebody that actually hasn't seen him talk, to have somebody that's is the center of such a famous case describe themselves, what had happened, what their viewpoint was, and Not what he
described the case point by point, and he had a PowerPoint with some artist renderings of scenes and location photographs of the actual site, and he started his presentation with some clips from that I guess it was in the late 80s Fire in the Sky movie.
Yeah.
As well as intercut with some talk show sequences, which must have been right after, I came on Oprah and things like that, right after the event.
Yeah. Did anybody ask him anything? Obviously there's questions afterward. Did anybody ask him anything that really made him or you or anybody else really think about some of the stuff he'd said or what has happened since then, or just some sort of perspective on the whole deal now, these, 30 years later?
I can't remember. People did go up and ask him. I remember one woman asked him and it was very funny because the way the mic was set up, this one woman who I'd actually met and I quite liked this woman, and she was very friendly, but she went up and she asked, do you think they abducted you because of the logging, because they were worried about the trees? And he couldn't hear her, so he kept on asking her to rephrase the question, and in her soft voice she would ask the question again, and he still couldn't hear her, the way the microphone was, he was on the stage and she was just off to the side of the stage, and finally someone screamed from the audience, she's asking, are they environmentalists?
How did he react?
And then he very, in his very soft-spoken way, said, "Oh no, I don't think that was it. We weren't actually logging. We were doing what's, he had a term for it. Like when you go in and clean up the slash piles and things like that, and then refill in the roads and things like that." So he was basically saying, "Oh no, we were doing the cleanup part. We weren't actually cutting down the trees."
So apparently the woman didn't even listen to him in the first place.
Well, you would never really know that because the footage on the 1980 movie, or whatever, late 80s movie, did have some scenes where they were actually portrayed as loggers, as opposed to, I guess they still are loggers, they're part of a logging crew, but they go in afterward.
Yeah.
It was funny. You would have no way of knowing from his presentation.
Right. I had Chica Bruce on last week, and she said that she got the impression that Dolan actually he enjoys doing his presentations.
Do you mean Travis Walton?
No, I'm sorry. I went back to Richard Dolan.
Oh, Richard Dolan, I think, enjoys doing his presentations. Sure, yeah.
That he likes to being at these conferences and giving these presentations. And I think he enjoys just as much talking to everybody, just like I do, because every time I'm at a conference and he's there at the same time, we end up talking for about 10 or 15 minutes anyway. Although I don't agree with everything he says, I do think he tries to be very thorough in what he does.
Yeah, and he's an impressive guy. Actually, I had a story I wanted to share with him, and it was impossible. It just was impossible. He's kind of the it boy of the whole scene right now. So anytime he walks into a room, there's kind of a scene that kind of gloms around him. And I actually watched him. There's a kind of a, off to the side, there's a spot with some tables, and it's not part of the main hall, and it's not part of the conference room. It's kind of this hallway that's tucked off to one side there. And there's some tables. People sit down. He was way in the back. And he was being interviewed by someone with someone from British radio, and you could see him back there nodding and talking very intensely into the microphone, and then he got up, he took about 10 steps, and he sat down in another chair, and then did a video interview, and it was very funny because you could sort of sense that just to get from one end of the hall to the other, he might never make it because there's so many people just itching to do interviews with him.
Yeah.
So, he was very much in demand there. And he was not there the entire time. His wife, Karen, was there, and she works with the internal workings there at the conference. And he showed up just on the day before his presentation, which was close to the end.
Yeah, and I know that Karen has a podcast too that she does. I've been on it once. I think I'm fairly sure she's still doing it. She's even done some presentations too at a couple conferences.
Yeah, she does presentations. She's been doing presentations on the weird alien imagery that shows up in children's entertainment at this point. Present day children's entertainment.
She seems to be worried about it.
Teletubbies and Booba and all these very bizarre sort of alien influenced children's television things.
I don't know if Booba's alien influence. A friend of mine, when he first saw it, described it to me as, what did he say? You know how the Teletubbies is like being on acid? He said, well, Booba is like being on DMT.
I've never actually seen it except for the little clips she showed, you know.
It is very strange.
You know, the show actually starts off with this, like, orb that, like, flies around playgrounds. It's this glowing orb that's, you know, straight out of, some UFO casebook, and all these kids, like, dance around it and, like, hooray, the orb is here. And so...
Oh, I see why she's upset. Because I've never seen the show, so...
I don't even know if it's still on. I mean, this was a couple years ago that I saw it.
Yeah, it might not be. I wonder why they picked that imagery. Is that some... You know, did that come from people's ideas of UFOs? Or, you know, did it come from...
Yeah. I worry it might be nefarious. You know, it might be like, someone might be mind-controlled and they're trying to, and they've somehow slipped themselves into the... to the upper echelons of children's television production, and they're forcing this stuff, into I don't believe this, but that I don't think she believes it either, but she does ponder that question.
Yeah. Why do you keep going to the conferences? What's the main reason? Do you find any answers there, or are you just kind of just part of the journey?
I enjoy them. I enjoy meeting the folks. I enjoy spending time with the folks. That just on the grassroots level, less so the people that are speaking, and more on the grassroots level. And one of the things I found fascinating the last 3 years at the Laughlin conference is each night they have they call it an experience or support group.
Oh yeah.
And I make an effort to attend all those, and I have for the last 3 years, and those are really. Really interesting.
Yeah, that's always says closed to press and outside people and all this. So obviously, I can't go into them. What happens in those things? Do people just talk?
I'm not sure what the only way I can. It's like just picture an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, a bunch of chairs in a circle, and a bunch of really, really normal looking folks that are kind of tense sitting in a circle. And then, 1 year it was Leo Sprinkle who ran it, and practicing therapist, a psychologist, will run these things the same way you would run any kind of support group, for people who have, people who suffered from trauma, children of alcoholic parents. I'm sure there's a million support groups in this realm. But, they open up, and does anyone want to say anything? And someone raises their hand, and they'll start talking, and that'll trigger someone else, and they'll raise their hand, and it'll go around, and it's wow. I mean, in fact, I used to talk with Mac about this. It's the ingredients for the most dramatic stage play imaginable.
what kind of, did people say exceedingly bizarre things? They must.
People say some exceedingly bizarre things.
Such as what?
And, it's interesting because if you had only read Dave Jacobs and Bud Hopkins, you would think you would go in there and you'd have people talking about evil, gray, emotionless doctors doing, creepy medical exams. And you get a little bit of that, but I would say about 60% is people telling stories of absolutely angelic, blissful experiences with angel-like Nordics and things. So it's very, very interesting. It defies what the popular culture image is of like the person who claims the UFO, whether it's abduction or contact or experience. So, the most of them are very pretty and joyous and overflowing with radiant positive. It might be a little naive, and it's a little treacly and a little sugar coated sometimes. I mean, that's what comes out of these things. It's very interesting.
Have you been going to those support groups for any amount of years at these conferences, or been to anything like
just
it?
Just these 3 years. And each time at Lawson, it's the only time I've ever done it.
Okay, because
excuse me?
I was wondering if over the years, even in your short experience with it, if the character of what people talked about had changed, or the you know, a lot of people's basic stories had changed, or indeed if there's some kind of pressure from other people in the group not to say anything negative. Do you get that feeling?
Well, there's certainly pressure. There's certainly like you know, not pressure from people, but there's certainly like people that will go back and forth, and it gets heated. I mean, I've seen it's like, you know, people cry and it's dramatic. I've seen people go back and forth, and you know, sometimes someone will have like the teary-eyed, beautiful, you know, heavenly angel that comes and just in a glowing white light of love, you know, enters their house, and then the other person will tell the story of the you know, the evil bastards that that do creepy medical exams, and there's tension between those two people, man, and I've seen them go at it. And then also, you know, the sad part is you get some folks that are, I'm not a trained therapist, or I'm not a, you know, a psychological professional of any way, but you get people who, you know, are probably mentally ill. And so it's a weird mix.
How do you know that the people are mentally ill or not by what they say?
Oh, just, like awkward social habits and things like that. They'll just start talking and just go on and on and on and on and on and not really come to any point. You know, when in a situation like that, you know, you don't have to be all that socially adept to realize like, oh, you're part of a little community and you know, of whatever, 15 people or so. And part of your, you know, your job there or your, you know, the actual support would be just to, you know, tell your story, keep it brief, be encouraging to other folks, and some folks just don't have those simple social skills, and they're a very small percentage, but a sad percentage. You know, I don't know what it would be. You know, it's sad and unsettling to see those folks.
Well, have you ever raised your hand and said anything at any of these?
Oh yeah, absolutely, and I'm very whatever. I've been weirdly open about this whole thing since I, you know, made the decision to look into it, which would have been the winter of 2006, I believe, 2005, 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And, and I've told my stories, and you know, some of them are, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, I'll tell a story, and you'll see people, like, on the circle, like, you know, kind of nod their head, you know, like, absolutely knowingly. You know, I'll describe some very subtle little sensation, and people on the other side of the room will you know, you'll see them nod their head. Or you can ask a question of folks and, like, you know, like, have you ever had this experience? And then a handful of people will raise their hand. It's very comforting. You know, I feel like I'm in a circle where you know, that's where the journey sort of proceeds forward in a way, not sitting in the lectern listening to Richard Dolan give a very, very eloquent and skilled talk. You know, I think the real insights I'm gaining are in these little circles. And I'll also say it's very funny because, you know, I mean, you've been to Laughlin. It's a creepy place with a, you know, casino downstairs with, you know, senior citizens staring blankly into the slot machines and stuff. And then what happens, that, you know, you go to these things for a few days and you know, the Laughlin conference is really weird because it's over a week long. And so you see the same people in the little support group, you know, kind of standing in line at Starbucks. And it's a very funny feeling to see that, you know, that cross-section of Joe Normal.
Yeah. yeah,
you know,
I just...
They're just doing everyday things, like, you know, getting a cup of coffee.
You want to talk about creepy? I just told Walter here... quietly, when I go to these conferences, I see sometimes you get like these little cards that have credits on them or something like that, and then you have to plug them into the slot machine,
mm-hmm.
and they don't take them off from around their necks,
right.
with the little lanyard, so they're like hooked
exactly.
into this machine.
They're obviously buying credit at the door.
I have one. for a casino down in San Diego because that's where our friend Craig and his wife and I will go eat at the buffet sometimes. So you get a membership, and it comes with the little stretchy cord that goes around your neck. So.
At Barona?
No, this is Pechanga.
Oh, Pechanga, okay.
And all that.
Yeah, it looks like a scene out of...
you're plugged in.
Oh, what's the... Matrix.
Yeah, they've got all these Brazil.
All these people staring into machines with these things coming out of their necks connected to the machines.
And smoking.
Yeah.
See, now what would an extraterrestrial think of that if they were to land and come to a casino in the first place they went to?
Well, that comes up. I mean, it's very strange because, you know, one of the things that shows up in these conference formats is like this transformative personal growth and you know, spiritual enlightenment, and all these things are kind of, you know, a subtext of this phenomenon, especially in the conference format. And then you have, you know, this, you know, tacky conference hall. There's nothing. I mean, it's just like they're going to, you know, roll the UFO conference out, and the plumbers conference is going to be in the next day. And so, and then, you know, downstairs is this the saddest chapter of human, you know, the taking advantage of people's weaknesses by having a, you know, this gambling there. You know?
Well, but not,
you know, the mental illness that can be defined as gambling addiction is just, you know, used to buy all these, you know, shiny lights on the main street there.
Well, but not all of them are addicts. I'd say the majority of them are just folks that's what they do on their holiday weekends is they go and, you know, ding, 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 ding. I find that I was being,
you know, purposely dramatic. Yeah.
Well, you know what's weird is I was kind of including myself in that because I'm actually not much of a gambler, but I find that ding, ding, ding sound rather pleasant, so it's probably working on my subconscious the way they designed it. But it doesn't work to the point where I'm loading money in those dumb things because, you know, I'm kind of with you on there. You know, it's talk about a waste of money.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's the only place they can have these conferences where they can actually afford the with the venue, I think, and to hold enough people, and it makes it a destination for some people, I guess. And Vegas is probably, you know, 10 times as expensive to rent the conference rooms and all that. So I think that's why it takes place in Laughlin and has been for
and
so many years.
Next year, the plan is, according to, like, you know, there's a lot of buzz about it, and there was a great big booth there, the folks from Open Minds... website, I think it's called Open Minds TV, the way it's listed on their web URL, is taking over the conference, and it'll be in Arizona at a different venue. So it'll be out in the desert with a separate building. It's part of an, if I'm not mistaken, it's part of an Indian reservation that has gambling on the premises, but it also has a hotel and convention center that's separate from the gambling center, like a fully separate building.
Yeah, this was the last year that Bob Brown and his family were putting it on.
Yeah.
I still can't remember what their reasoning was. I think they're just tired of it. And also they're probably not making as much money at this point as they thought they would. I don't think that the Browns lost money the last few years. I think they're actually doing okay with it. But I guess I'm glad that it's still going on. It's just that I'd like to see some different guests there. Personally, that's just me.
And yeah, I think that came up. I think that was they seem to be receptive to that. The Open Minds folks. I definitely cornered a few of them and gave some unedited you know, opinions of what my hopes were for the next presentation.
Yeah, I mean, get Nick Redfern, but also get him to talk about what he thinks is going on, not about his Chupacabras investigation or whatever it is that it's popular for him to talk about. Get him to talk about something that's not too many people talk about. Like, what does he really think that's going on? What does he think the government's doing? What does he think the role is? Get an abduction researcher that seems to be doing things a little differently, who I can't think of any right now. It's probably somebody that's doing things that you don't even know about. You might. And then also people like you who could just let people know how truly weird and bizarre some of this stuff is, and how that the, you know, the nonsense that surrounds it, there might be a message in that nonsense. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I do know. Yeah, and it's that would be you know, the whole year before the next conference, and it might be worth lobbying those folks because I think they are struggling with that question. You know, like, who do we get? And I think they're going to try to pack in more, is my understanding. I can't quite make sense of what they're planning to do. There was a little bit of talk that they're going to have, you know, 6 speakers a day, potentially, over 4 days, as opposed to, I can't remember, this is 7 or 8 days, this conference.
Yeah, because I think it to me, it's time, and I wanted to do this, but I don't have the money until I get somebody to pay for it. But, hey, you know what we should do is get a couple copies of Mac Tony's books and sell them for $5,000 instead of $9,000. We get 4 or 5 of those sold, we got a conference.
yeah, we got it's the illuminated black book, though, isn't it? Is that one that's
yes.
hard to find?
Yes. That's the other subject I wanted to talk about on the show, obviously, and I think I'd announced it on UFO Mystic, was how you met Mac Tony's, what effect he had on you, and what you guys talked about. But that's many questions in one. Maybe the first one first. How did you guys get acquainted?
Actually, this would have been... I actually just figured it out because I've been writing a bunch of stuff out on my blog. I went kind of a flurry this just after the New Year's. But I, as far as writing about, you know, Mac, and I heard him on... Banal of America. I'd never, didn't know anything about him. Heard his voice in Banal of America, and I was kind of blown away. I was kind of like, wow, this guy, you know, guy, I got to talk to this guy. And I was pretty shameless about like, you know, I need to, like, just connect with this guy. And at the time, I was working on prepping a documentary. And so there was a fellow in the town that I was living in here who was a producer and had done some low-budget Hollywood features. And I live in a small ski town, just eastern Idaho, and so it's kind of a destination place. People will come here and have, you know, this fellow, this producer that was doing the documentary, lives in the town here, so I was eating lunch with him and stuff, so I felt like I could just pursue these things. Like, well, I can just call this guy up and ask him if he wants to be on the documentary. And that was kind of subordinate. The real reason, I just wanted to talk to him. But that was my, you know, so I literally looked up in the phone book. He was in Kansas City, Missouri, and I just looked him up on the internet, and there he was. There was his name, and I dialed his phone number up, and he picked up the phone, and we started talking. And that would have been shortly after that presentation, the talk that he did on, the interview he did on in All of America, which would have been spring of 07, I think.
Yeah.
So, and then after that, you know, we just started calling each other up. You know, we would make an appointment on email, and I would call him up, and then there was a lot of email back and forth between us, and he was, I have to say, he was super supportive of, you know, both blogs that I've been doing. One, the illustration blog, he was a huge fan of my illustration work, which actually meant a lot to me, and he commented on all kinds of stuff, and he was really funny and wry in his comments, and you know, it's interesting because over the last 20 years, I guess that's 20 years now, I've been since 1990, which is 20 years ago, that sounds hard to say, but I've been reading a lot of on the subject of the UFO thing, and then since the advent of the internet, it's like this bottomless pit of information that's out there, and I've kind of... compulsive or compulsion or is as good a word as any, but I've been reading a lot on the subject, so I feel pretty well versed in book knowledge, and it was really great because Mac, the whole reason I was sought Mac out was it felt like he was articulating stuff better than I could. He was like articulating what I thought in the back of my mind, and I could never quite get it out, you know, and he would say it so smoothly and so brilliantly, and he was basically saying what I thought. So that's why I pursued him, and that was the sort of the conversations we were having. We were on the same page with a lot of stuff as far as our thoughts.
Yeah, it's funny, but it was you coming from an experiential, I guess, sort of route, and him coming from as far as I know, he never really had any weird experiences. He was just very interested in the subject matter, well-read, and obviously, and thinking originally about it, or at least original in the way that is resonated with me. Did you ever get the feeling from him that he did have some sort of strange experiences? Because he never mentioned it once to me. And I think I even asked him about it.
No, and I pressed him on it. He didn't. A couple things that he was born, his birthday, the day he was born, was the day the original Mars, I think it was called the Viking.
Right.
Went, you know, lifted off. That was the day he was born. So he did say that he could, there was a traffic light in his, or a street light in his neighborhood that he could, would turn off every time he walked under it. So that was as close to paranormal as he got.
Yeah, I think a lot of, I used to have that too in the neighborhood where I grew up. I would walk under a street light and it would turn off. And I thought it was cool. I thought, hey, I can control the street light. I don't know how I do it.
And I don't know. That's a very common story. And I have no idea quite what to make of that. Because it happens to me on rare occasions. And oftentimes on very bizarre occasions. Like, I'll be thinking about something. Like, I'll ask a question to myself. And in essence, the street light will give me the answer.
Yeah, in one of your blog entries on Hidden Experience, you wrote about picking up Mac Tony's manuscript for the Cryptoterrestrials finally after kind of hemming and hawing about reading it, and you had a CD player that popped a CD out automatically for no reason whatsoever when you finally picked the book up.
Yeah, and it was very funny because the house was quiet, and I purposely, like, you know, I was a little intimidated to open it.
Me too.
I was, made a cup of tea. I had my reading glasses on the coffee table. I put the manuscript on a three-ring binder, and it was on the coffee table. And I sat down, and the house was quiet, and I opened the manuscript up and read the first few words. And right at that moment, the CD thing made this, electric clicking noise and kind of ejected, and it's never done that. I mean, I've had the CD player in my house here for, 15 years or something like that, and it's never done that. So that, that doesn't mean much. I can't really, start a new religion on that kind of, that kind of coincidence. But, so that definitely did happen, and that was shortly after he died.
What was the CD?
You know, it wasn't that interesting. It was the soundtrack to John Waters' Hairspray. So...
I have that too.
I was hoping it would be something really beautiful. And some blog commenters, talked all about, that it's using a laser beam, and isn't that interesting? This is actually something that was weird between Mac and I, and we never directly talked about it. He wrote, and I figured this out. I actually went through and figured out the date on his blog, but he wrote and he read it aloud. And I stole that little clip of him reading this little essay aloud, but it was an essay about him playing with his cat with a laser pointer.
Yeah, that's up on your site. And you're going to talk about it, I'm sure. You had the same essay you'd written, sort of the same essay you'd written either before or after him by a few months, and you didn't even know about his.
I had never even heard of him at this point. So I had written it, and it took me a while to figure it out because... in the back of my mind, it always seemed odd. It's like, well, wait a minute, we wrote the same thing, because I did stumble on his written story once I found his blog, which would have been months after writing my own. And, it was very interesting. He wrote a story about playing with his cat and the laser pointer, and I wrote a story about playing with my cat and a piece of string, which is interesting. You know, him ever the futurist and me sort of ever the, one of the things I do is teach a form of ultralight camping where I go out with very minimal gear into the mountains. And so I thought that was funny that I was,
Yeah, but the metaphor was humans and the UFO phenomenon. You both connected it to that. That's what the interesting thing was. And I think I'd sort of heard the same idea, but not like you said, right, with Mac. And both a lot more eloquently... express the way you two wrote about it, about the cat sees this thing, it thinks it's something living, it's controlled by something, and the cat really isn't aware.
He's looking at the, so the way I wrote it was that, when I wiggle the string on the floor, the cat thinks the string is alive, and it doesn't look at my hand wiggling the string. It looks at the tip of the string down on the floor. The same way that, you know, the cat doesn't look at the at Mac with a laser pointer. It looks at the little red dot on the carpet. And so the cat, I'm paraphrasing from memory now. My cat's running up to me as I say this. The cat, you know, does the cat require the string to achieve its catness? You know, when the cat is actually playing with the string, it's totally excited and happy and living and alive, and you know, runs around and rolls on its back, and does the cat need that string to achieve its sort of aliveness? This, and what do we need as people? You know, we see reports of people seeing a UFO in the sky. But what are they seeing? You know, are they seeing the tip of the string? Are they seeing the red dot on the carpet? You know, what's going on? You know, who's projecting that? Yeah, so we've in essence made the same points. And this gets very strange because I remember the morning I wrote that essay. I remember I probably drank a second cup of coffee and I was sitting at the computer checking my email in the morning. And I remember just compulsively writing it. I don't remember planning to write it. I just started writing it. It just seemed like a nice little essay. And it wrote itself, which is silly to say, but it kind of wrote itself. And within a few minutes, it was all done. I can't remember what I did, but I just kind of tucked it away and didn't do anything with it. And that ended up being, this gets very strange, that ended up being the very first posting on my blog when I started the paranormal blog.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first comment on the very first posting was from Mac Tony's, and he said, "Hey, we're on the same page. I wrote almost the same essay with a laser pointer."
I noticed you just put up a review of the Cryptoterrestrials here on Amazon.
Oh yes, I saw you beat me to it. So yeah.
As soon as I saw
your name was one ahead of me.
Yeah, as soon as I saw that it was for sale, I for some reason I wasn't doing anything else and I felt compelled and I just wrote those three paragraphs. And I hope, you know, as soon as people start commenting, they're going to say, "Well, that's the illustrator and one of the people that worked on the book. So why should?"
That happens all the time. That happens all the time. And I've worked on a bunch of books over the years, and I'm shameless about getting right in there and playing self-promoter on my own books. How much you need to have one of these.
We didn't do it because we were trying to play self-promoter. We're trying to promote Mac's vision to people because I think more people need to see it. Obviously.
Yeah. Well, that is in essence. Yeah, I think that's very true. I think the book is typical of his writing. It's typical of his spoken word, too. He's really, really thorough and insightful, and he says a lot in a very few sentences.
Do you think that people reading this need a background in the UFO subject to make any sense out of the book or the most sense out of it, or do you think somebody coming in with no preconceived ideas about it will get the same amount out of it? Because I argue that they're people kind of need to have a background in the UFO thing before they dive into this because it's going to change their mind, and the act of changing their mind is what is going to stay with them, not being presented with all this incredibly detailed and original information in the first place.
Well, I mean, I think culturally everyone at any shopping mall in America has a background on this stuff, and it's
true.
We're flooded with it in our popular culture, and I think that, you know, maybe we're flooded, that, you know, the statistical cross-section of America may have a slightly inaccurate perception of what's going on, but everyone has you know, the basic, you know, foundation of these, you know, the UFO phenomenon, whether it's the abduction phenomenon, whether it's the funny government secret phenomenon, or it's Roswell, or, you know, that's as common as, you know, where Santa Claus lives in the North Pole. Everyone knows that.
I never really thought about that, but I think you're right. But do you think that would be a – do you think somebody coming from that mindset, just kind of the popular image of what – of aliens and UFOs is about, will be able to hook in immediately to the – at least, you know, a reasonably intelligent person, hook in immediately to what the message of the book is?
I think so. I mean, yeah, he's very clear about it. And he's very – he's also – this is actually one of the things that I missed that sort of clarity that Mac had, where he was very skilled at saying, well, let's speculate on this. And then he would muse on something for a paragraph or so, and then he would say, no, I'm done speculating. As opposed to people, it doesn't show up. If you go to Laughlin, man, there are a lot of people who need that lesson where they talk about stuff like it's written stone, and they talk about stuff like it's already fact. So he's very skilled. Like, if you read any of his writings, when he's speculating, he's speculating. And he makes a lot of references to other books and other authors and other researchers, and he does a good job of citing them and making sure the sources are it's not footnoted like something from a college thesis, but it's definitely he'll reference Jacques Vallée and Bud Hopkins and their books.
Yeah, there's there was an interview on the Paracast I was on about a week after Mac died, and it's funny. I remember Patrick Weege asking me directly. He said, "Do you think Mac believed this stuff he was writing?" And I said, "No, Patrick. I think he was speculating. I think he was speculating in an intelligent way and saying, 'Let's consider this,' but not use it as the bedrock of whatever belief system, whatever, because he jumps belief systems like changing a channel, which is great. I love that."
Exactly. And he was good at saying, now I'm reaching over and changing the channel to right. another channel. So it's very clear. It wasn't confusing anytime, especially speaking with him one-on-one.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. If you go back and re-listen to the 2007 interview that he did on Tim Banal,
mm-hmm.
He's coming from a place where he was a little more formal in his saying, that the crypto-terrestrial hypothesis is a parallel species that is living here right now, right on Earth. And over the years, as I talked with him, should have been on just about 2 years, it wasn't really that much, he changed that, and it became much more mystical and much more interdimensional, and sounded much more much less like he was talking about something that was living in a cave under the earth, and much more like something that was living in a mystical realm just beyond our perception.
Yeah, that's funny, because that's the feeling I get from it, and from talking to him, and I'm sure you talk to him quite a bit. The feeling I got from talking to him was that, these things, whatever it is, could be living underground. But let's consider some other exciting stuff. If we're gonna accept that they come from somewhere that's connected to us intimately, why don't we speculate that it's someplace that we have a common ground in, which might be this mystical space, as you call it.
And that definitely evolved over the last couple of years, and it was interesting because you can hear it in the context. If you compare the Tim Banal interview from 07 mm-hmm. to the George Norrie interview from, I guess it was September of 09. It was I think that's right. He evolved as a his hypothesis and his skills at describing it were just so beautiful, and. It was much more, the path, he referred to it as a thought experiment over and over and over again, the crypto-terrestrials. He basically
right.
said, I'm not wed to this idea, it's a thought experiment, and no one else has done it, and I just might as well tackle it, because it seems interesting, and that was his vibe as he went into it, which was great, I thought, because it was refreshing, and it wasn't, driven by, I don't want to say by ego. There was nothing like needy
dogma.
Or clingy to it. Like if you contradicted him or disagreed with him, there was no sense of. He never got like puffy. Like I mean, just like there's so many people on the field that would, storm off if you disagreed with even just a minor point.
Yeah, I tend to myself stick with people that. Are fairly open about what they think, and also really non-dogmatic or defensive about it. If somebody's defensive about something, at some point you wonder if they really have something, because they have to be so defensive. I mean, if you think there's a deficiency there, you're going to be unsure and you're going to get defensive. And That's what I said when I was describing your website and the talks I've had with you, and Walter too, actually. None of these people that I tend to stick with and keep talking to and consider my friends is, you can have a horrible argument, but then you can have a beer afterwards and nobody cares.
Yeah, and it's interesting because my own set of experiences are so ethereal, and they're so based on memories. Some of the memories are a long time ago, and they're very hard to quantify, and that I'm more mixed up. It bugs me sometimes because I'll meet these researchers, you know, in a conference situation. I'll tell them my story, and they'll nod and kind of knowingly finish my sentence for me, and I kind of want to go, oh, don't do that, you know, like this is like how do you know?
Yeah,
and they'll make assumptions that I choose not to make, and often assumptions involve like a giant leap, you know, to like, you know, these assumptions are weighted down with some heavy stuff that I can't, you know, I just don't have any personal experience to go there, but they'll read between the lines of what I'm saying and then make that jump for me, and I'm like, no, thank you.
Yeah, and I'm sure this happened to you. People will come up to me and start sharing whatever experience it is, and 90% of it is just they want to get it off their chest to somebody that isn't going to run away or laugh at them.
And that's the joy of being at a UFO conference. I mean, oftentimes you start your sentence like, if this was any other place, I wouldn't tell you this, but in this format, you know, here goes. And you can't really go to a party in your hometown and have the same conversation. So that's actually is more than anything, that's the reason I go to these things. And I love hearing the stories too, as much as sharing my meager little experiences.
What does listening to these stories do for you? I mean, are you past a point where you really care whether people believe you or not?
I like when people believe me. and oftentimes at a UFO conference, people are very open to believing.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is that I think if you sat down with books that you got, Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs, who both of whom I've met and both of whom I like enormously, and I think they're doing important research, but I think that when you talk to the individual, the story that emerges is so much more bizarre than this kind of formalized story that appears in our pop culture, you know, through the mainstream, if there's such a thing, the mainstream UFO researchers. Talk to a person on an individual level, and it gets so weird. And it's weirder than you'd be led to believe if you'd only read, books off the bookshelf at Barnes & Noble.
You know, as you say that, I reminded, and you did reference her, Carla Turner. I interviewed her in 1995 or 4, and she's one of the quotes I remember from her. That was printed in the interview that went in the magazine and is now in the book, the Excluded Middle book, was she said, I think any answers we find or new directions is going to come from the anomalous details, not from the rote story. The anomalous details that a lot of these people ignore. And it sounds like you would agree with that.
Well, it's interesting, and I have this on videotape where the documentary, we actually did start this documentary and we shot a bunch of footage, and the documentary sort of petered out and it's not really going anywhere right now. So there's an interview with Bud Hopkins where he says, you know, I ask him, you know, like, what about the odd information? Like, you must get some really weird information. And he kind of rolled his eyes and he said, it was almost like he made this hand gesture, like he was trying to gather in things, you know, like he was trying to, like if you're on a table and you're trying to like collect the marbles and push them all to the middle. And he said, you know, the spider web just goes everywhere. And I have to, you know, to leave some stuff out. And I have to, in order to make, the story, so the story just wouldn't, he basically says the story would be so huge if I didn't leave out these outliers. And he readily admits that. And then you talk to him personally, And once the camera's off and stuff, and he, boy, man, he'll tell you some weird stories that, that like you wouldn't have expected from him. Yeah, I agree that these odd little things that are showing up, and almost the thing that I've that seems so weird is that talking to folks is that the personal, these stories are so deeply personal, and they are different from person to person.
Yeah,
you know, just like how it changes people's lives and things is very interesting.
Yeah, there's a clue there, though, the personal and the how personal it is and how different the stories are. That seems to indicate, tell me if you agree with this, that whoever's experiencing it, whatever it is, their interaction with whatever it is and their individuality is way more important to the story than a lot of people would have you believe.
Yeah, there's a book, Bud Hopkins wrote a book called Intruders.
Yes.
Which is very interesting. And then, I can't remember her name. I want to say Debbie wrote a book about her personal experience. So you could read one book by Bud Hopkins, you know, the formal researcher,
mm-hmm.
you know, approaching it as a you know, unbiased researcher. And then you could read the first-person story that she wrote. And I read those back-to-back. And it was fascinating how different they were. I think, I mean, you know, the all the points that Bud made in his book were in the other book, but just the depth and the weirdness of it when it, you know, you talk to her, well, not talk to her, but when you read her work directly, I'm trying to remember the name of that book.
As someone who's experienced yourself as I am, what comes to mind? All the things you were just talking about, and you and Greg about how personal these things are. My personal conclusion is the most profound, intense experiences I've had, I indeed feel like something, someone intelligent was sending this to me, communicating this with me. And some people would say, well, you just have an awareness more of the things around you and in a general sense. And my response is no. My very personal experience is I felt like I was dealing with an intelligent, conscious individual who was, I guess you'd say, opening the door or sending these things my way. I don't know. As an experiencer yourself, where do you fall with that?
That's hard to answer because it's so bizarre, you know. And then there's so many things that I how to say. In 1974, I had an event where I had a missing time event of up to 2 hours. It's hard to know exactly. When I was walking home from a high school football game, I knew right when I left the football game, and I knew when I expected to be home. I wanted to be home in time to see a television show. And I walked past a friend's house. I was walking home with a friend named Mike. His name was also Mike. And I walked past a friend's house, Cindy, and she was a half mile between the high school and my house, and her house was actually very close to my house, and I was in her driveway, and there was a weird orange flash in the sky, and I looked up and I saw this orange flash, and my friend saw it too, and the only way I can describe it, it felt like it was a calm, beautiful Midwestern, I grew up in Michigan, Midwestern autumn night. And it felt like God flipped the light switch on and flipped it right off. And both me and my friend, we were 12 years old at the time, said, well, that was weird. What just happened? That was really jarring. That kind of was really weird. It was silent, and we talked about meteors. That didn't make any sense. We talked about lightning, but that didn't make any sense because it was such a calm, clear night. We talked about, you know, something, you know, like something from the electric company or, you know, like some power line zapping, you know, over the horizon, but it didn't look like that. It looked different. And then when I got home, my parents were angry at me because I was out so late. And the next Monday at school, I remember trying to talk about it in the cafeteria with my friend Mike. And he said, you know, in a crowd of people, he said, yeah, we saw a UFO with lights and everything. And I immediately, like, just just clammed up because I never saw a UFO with lights, and I just saw the sky light up orange, and my first thought was, this is how stories get blown out of proportion.
Mm-hmm.
But now, so that way I would have been 12 years old. I completely dismissed that story. I forgot about it for decades. And then as I started reading these UFO books, I was kind of like, well, that story, that has a lot of implications to it. So I was started the blog, and the blog had started as a response to Laughlin last year in 2009. I was very much compelled to start the blog. So my first bunch of blog stories were these kind of sweet, harmless synchronicity stories, and then there came a day when I knew I had to write up the orange flash in the sky story.
I remember that one.
Yeah, and I wrote it up, and it was all set aside, and it was as written as a diary entry, and so it was all done. And I actually had a Google Earth image of Cindy's house with a yellow X on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
And I knew right where it was, you know, where the event took place. Now, I was going to post it. And it was evening time at night, and I was sitting in front of my computer, and there came this, like posting that story was a big deal. Like, that was, like, I couldn't go through with it. I had my hands over the keyboard. I felt like a total coward, and I realized, like, I'm not brave enough to go forward and, like, declare to the world that I had a two-hour missing time event. And in that moment, not a second later, not a second afterwards, I had a little ping on my email, so I decided, well, I can avoid this whole thing and just, like, check my email and distract me.
Yeah.
And the email was from that woman, Cindy.
Yeah.
And I hadn't talked to Cindy in 38 years, and she chose that minute to email me. She found me on Facebook, and I immediately, you know, contacted her through Facebook, and we did a little chat thing back and forth and talked about, I think it was like 2 hours that night, and I sent her all the info that I was about to send, and, you know, basically just gushed and said, you know, I had a two-hour missing time event, you know, a friend, but he saw a UFO, and I never did. And as far as, like, the personal communication that you were talking about, the only way I can describe it is, you know, like in the beginning of the wonderful world of Disney, Tinkerbell flies around and the little sparkles come off her magic wand.
Yeah.
I was sitting alone in my house and it literally felt like magic sparkles were like sprinkling around everything. It was that communication from the woman Cindy, who I had a picture of her house on my computer, was so intensely personal. And that event, not the event of the missing time in 1974, but the slap in the face with this... you know, her choosing to contact me at that second was amazing. And I'll add that since then, this woman Cindy she's her own, like, you know, machine as far as, like, crazy stuff in her life. I've talked with her a bunch since then, and she is now, among other things, is working as a psychic for Scotland Yard over in England.
You know, you mentioned the sparkly effect, you know, the Tinkerbell effect, or nature of some of this. And it reminded me immediately of Glamoury, which is a phenomenon associated with the legendary fairy folk. And these they will use Glamoury to appear in a more appealing form to us in our dimension. And as soon as I think of that, I think of Jacques Vallée and John Keel and, you know, some of the stuff that they bring to the table on all this that to me seems all too often dismissed and set aside by the current UFO community. And to me it's frustrating because all these things you're talking about and the things I've experienced and, you know, and Greg and Mac and all of them, it just seems to me to be a much more integral part of the whole UFO experience, but there is this reluctance to allow it to be in an official capacity. And I just think they're overlooking the truth is somewhere in all the mix, not just, you know, what our pet theories are.
Yeah, and when I said the Tinkerbell spark, sparkles. I was sort of speaking metaphorically. It had that magic feeling. I didn't actually see the Tinkerbell sparkles in my room.
No, I understood that. Yeah,
like a fairy, like a little, you know, spritel or whatever.
I understand that.
My metaphor.
But, yeah, and I understood it was a metaphor, but it's still the phenomena of what would they call glamoury. It leaves an impression to make you use a metaphor like that. So yeah, I understood what you meant by that, but I was just saying it's kind of that's what I thought of, and that led me down to Jacques Vallée and John Keel territory.
Yeah, and I basically said, you know, there was the last 20 years I've been reading like compulsively on the subject, and I'm pretty sure I have every book by both those authors, you know, in the room that I'm sitting in right now. And those, the three Jacques Vallée books that he put out in the late 80s, early 90s, had more of an influence on me than any other thing I've ever read.
Have you read People of the Web, Greg Little's book?
No.
That you might like a lot. It's almost like a bridge between Keel and what Mac just wrote to me. And he's commented at UFO Mystic, and I want to get him on the show at some point. He's now involved with underwater anomalies off the South Atlantic coast of the United States, but he's still very much hooked into the anomalies, not really community, but the subject matter.
Chris O'Brien's Trickster book was great as far as, you know, collecting all that stuff into a big, you know, you know, he didn't leave anything out, it felt like.
Yeah, he is very thorough in that book, and I'd recommend that to anyone. I mean, there's a list of New Thought books that people ought to, you know, take the time to read that arc of thought from the 1960s up to now. And that would include, like you said, recently Chris O'Brien's book, Mac's book, Greg Little's People of the Web, and Jim Brandon's Rebirth of Pan, which is very hard to find. But
Greg Braden's book?
Jim Brandon.
Oh, Jim Brandon, okay.
Yeah, it's a pseudonym for, what's his name? Grimstad is his last name.
Okay.
Anyway, it's a book about Earth energies, about UFOs, about, it was written before the crop circle thing, but I'm sure he would have had something to say about that. But the main point of the book is that there is some native energy or intelligence inherent probably in the structure of the Earth and the things that live upon it that manifests as these tricksterish elements that Chris O'Brien talks about. And he wrote this book in the, I believe, the mid-'80s, early to mid-'80s. So this is, you know, way the hell back when, which is what I said. I mean, that book and Greg Little's book seemed to me like bridges between the first shot fired, you know, by Vallée and Keel and a couple others like them, and then more recently stuff like your blog and Mac's book and Chris O'Brien.
I would like to throw something in here. I went to a UFO con in which I'll name one of the guys, but I won't name the other just to not cause a bar fight, not to insult anyone, but Joseph Farrell was there speaking, and he was at his table, and a very well-known UFO researcher came up to him, very, very friendly, you know, great guy, friendly guy. But the thing he said was, oh, you're not one of those that doesn't believe that Roswell wasn't an extraterrestrial solution, or that, you know, the extraterrestrials aren't the answer to it, you know. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I would expect a researcher of any stature to be
to walk up and say, what is your, I hear that you don't really accept the extraterrestrial explanation. What is your reasoning?
Yeah. And be open to it. But yeah, this was like, oh, you're not, you know, that. And actually, personally, I find a lot of Joseph's stuff a lot more reasonable than most UFO explanations.
Yeah.
There's this line that blends into religion, which I find really creepy. You know, where you know, religion, you know, why I just think of, like, you know, like the Vatican, where there's just these rules as far as what you are required to believe.
Yeah.
A dogma. You know, Jesus walked on water kind of stuff, and you know, which may well may be true, but that's asking a lot to believe that. And I think that the UFO community has anointed itself with these belief systems.
Yeah, I mean, it's something, as you know, that I've complained about over and over and over and over for probably the past 3 or 4 years, and a few years before that. And other people have done it, too. Mac, in his gentle way, did the same thing. Nick has. Chris O'Brien definitely has. And he's got, unlike me, he's got the teeth to do it, because he's actually been out in the field working hard, talking to these people in a very strange area for a long time. And that's, he changed from the it's all aliens coming from other planets to wait a second here, there's a lot more to this story than aliens coming from other planets, which could be it, but you're ignoring so much by following that path and limiting yourself.
I think there's more than one it. Is the answer here.
Yeah.
That's the thing, is there's several things that make up the answer.
Do you, Mike, do you think that I've got this idea that just our language and our belief system is just totally throwing us off the track, and like you said, pushing away the whole spectrum of the bizarreness of what's going on. It sounds like you're kind of on that same. Well, when you say you're on the same wavelength as Mac was, I would suspect that you have that same feeling. And if you do, maybe you could elaborate on it.
Sure. I mean, it's very interesting because there's like this. We're so simplistic as people in a way, collectively on the planet, where we're set up to have either or, and there's like this line, and they can't cross the line. It's one thing or the other, and I think it's more both and there's like a crazy blurriness that occurs there that by our limited perceptions, I think that maybe these, angelic blonde aliens maybe can see through the other dimension the same way that we can see with the lights on in the room. And it's not as mysterious to them, but it's certainly mysterious to us with our limited perceptions. I don't know. I mean, is it, that there's something, I listen to Stanton Freeman, and he's a great speaker, and I've read some of his books, and he's a good writer, and I think he's interesting, and as he goes along and writes, and I just get right on the train, and I'm like, wow, this is fascinating. He's making all these great analogies. So cool. And then I, listen to, then I read, John Keel, and I get swept up in that, and I totally, get all. And both of them are valid, both of them are legitimate avenues of research. But I don't know which is which, and which to trust and which to believe in. From my own personal firsthand experience, it seems like I'm dealing with nature spirits. It seems like I'm dealing with this is just an impression. I have no way to prove it. I have no way to back it up. I have very few witnesses that were experienced the same thing I experienced, but. It seems like I'm dealing with some magical little guardian angel from the great beyond, just behind the curtain, that'll just nudge me periodically. And it does not feel like I'm dealing with an alien from another planet. That is not the impression I get in my gut. It might be, but that's not the way I feel. And just coming back from Laughlin, I mean, people were just like, they were just referring to the Pleiadians the same way that you would refer to if someone walked down the street, you could say that's a German Shepherd, that they're walking on their leash, they would, jump back and forth between the, Arcturians and the Pleiadians and the Zeta Reticulas, in such a matter-of-fact way that I can't go there. Because that's like saying, I'm sure people back in ancient Greece were capable of saying, the gods live on Mount Olympus, and some are, it's Zeus and this lady with snakes in her hair and stuff, and they would have this nice formatted idea of how it all worked, and I think there's people out there right now that have a nice tidy definition of what's going on out there, but I don't know where to begin. It doesn't feel like that to me in my gut. That was a long-winded answer. I'm not sure if I made sense.
That made perfect sense, because it's so rare Well, maybe not on this show because I don't talk to people that are dogmatic, but it's so rare to hear somebody say, I don't know. If I have to be honest, yeah.
Especially in Laughlin.
Yeah, if I have to be honest with myself, I don't know. I have an impression. I know what other people say, and I know what it feels like to me, but as for other people and what the answer is, I have no, I wouldn't begin to have an answer here. And it's funny because people make fun of Whitley Strieber and say he's gone nuts and all this, but his basic message was, this happened to me. It is my personal experience. It may be different for other people. And I think he really does push the idea, as you do, that whatever it is, whatever the is personal for each person that experiences it. And you can't really sit in a room and tell everybody what is it is and have them just, you know, and if it happened to them, have the same thing happen to them. It's just so all over the map. And I, you know, I didn't know that about Bud Hopkins. I thought he just ignored stuff because he thought it was crap. He's ignoring it because he can't get a message out that sounds too bizarre because then people won't listen.
Well, he also says, you know, collectively, you know, in his defense, the way he phrased it, and I'm just paraphrasing now, but the way he phrased it was just like, the story just gets so big, and I have to rein it in a little bit. He said the spider webs, I think the quote was something to the effect of, you know, like you have a spider web and the little threads just go everywhere and you just have to rein it in. And you can't tell that whole bit, all of that.
Yeah, well,
and my gut reaction is like, oh, some of those threads are pretty interesting. And that I found the book. I'm sitting here and that was written by the woman. It's Debbie Jordan and Kathy Mitchell.
Jordan, that's
the
it.
The book is called Abducted. I don't know if it's still available, but it's really interesting, read side by side with Bud Hopkins' Intruders.
Yeah, it's called the Strange Something at the Copley Woods or something like that.
That's Whitley.
Oh, that's Hopkins.
With Intruders.
Yeah.
Let me see if I get it on my shelf here. Yeah, here it is. I got it right here. Intruders, Incredible Visitations at Copley Woods by Bud Hopkins. And that was written in, just open it up.
87.
Hike. 87. And then the Abducted book was written in.
A little later. Like 2 or 3 years later, I think.
94.
Okay, yeah, 2 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never read that book. I think I have it.
Side by side, and they, you know, I think that both books are excellent. Both books are valuable, and both books are really interesting.
That's the other thing. You know, we're talking here, and we're just saying, oh, this person, well, I am anyway. This person doesn't have it, and this person doesn't have it. But the thing is, they all have little pieces of it, and they all seem, you know, they come from their own personal view of what it is, it, whatever's causing these things. And the thing is, if you've experienced it yourself, half the time you're saying, no, 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 no. And for people outside of it, they don't know what to make of it. It just sounds totally insane.
Eyes sometimes when I told them my stories, and there's this point where, like, they think I'm insane, and that's a really, you know, it makes your heart sink to recognize that in people. But you know, that when talking to Max, the metaphor I used a lot is the little story of the blind men and the elephant. You know, there's a handful of blind men, and they all walk up to the elephant, and one touches the trunk and has an explanation, and then one touches the tail and has a totally different explanation of what they're touching, and one touches the ears, and I think that's what's going on, but there's like this extra level of weirdness where, you know, I think Dave Jacobs is doing legitimate research. I visited his office. I mean, he's got an office with thousands, and I'm not exaggerating, thousands of cassettes, recordings of hypnosis sessions, all lined up, all, you know, all tidy, all numbered and dated, and I think he takes that stuff very seriously. But, you know, in a way, he's one of those blind men touching only the tail of the elephant, and maybe there's some sort of psychic, you know, psychic. You know, does he send out some funny ESP vibe where he only attracts the people that will exactly match his research. I have no way to prove that or anything like that, but that's kind of the impression I get. Does Leo Sprinkle, who's got a much more mystical side to him, you know, does he, the people that go to Leo Sprinkle, are they the people that are supposed to go to Leo Sprinkle? There's an anecdotal sense that that might be true.
Yeah, well, there's that sense, which you might not be able to prove to too many people. And then there's the other sense that the people that don't fit with what their message is, they just kind of ignore. Or if they don't fit it when they meet them, they certainly fit it after a few weeks in the chair with them.
Yeah.
Even though they're not consciously trying to do that.
Yeah, taking place, are the people pre-molded before they walk into the office? Or do they get molded as soon as they walk in? Is the researcher leaving out key data so it fits their hypothesis that even though they may say they don't have it in our, I think that human nature, nobody is that, open-minded and unbiased, especially on something that's bizarre.
Yeah, well, you can't be, but the problem, I think, for me is that they, with the exception, now you say, of Bud Hopkins, maybe, they refuse to acknowledge that they've only got the tail or the ear or whatever it is.
There's that. I mean, that's human nature, though.
Yeah, well, that's
that
too bad.
That we can't, that research may be describing the tail very well, and then when it comes time to define the entire elephant, that data on the tail is going to be important and valid.
Right, exactly. Oh, yeah, I can complain about the narrow-mindedness of it, but there's also the thing that there's thousands and thousands and thousands of data points, and maybe somebody's going to come along at some point and pull up a whole bunch of other data points that put these earlier ones in a whole new light or look at it in a different way, like Mac did, and sort of start molding it into – God, language is such a bitch, isn't it? Start molding it into something that may model what the is of it is a little bit better than the previous researcher or previous generation or whatever. And so many times people don't even realize that. They're just kind of like, we've got the answer and here it is. And they're very impatient. And if anything, I'm sure you would agree with this, if anything, the phenomenon itself has so much patience we can't even begin to conceive.
And I would add playfulness,
yes,
as well as patience.
Yeah. Maybe it's trying to help. I don't know.
You know, it's very interesting. This goes back to that little essay that I was talking about, the cat and the string. You know, like my cat, who's very funny and she's very playful, and I said this before, where she achieves her catness. Like, in order to be a cat, she's got to run around on the floor and she's got to chase the string, and in order to achieve that, she needs the string. Now, as humans, are we closed-minded, pragmatic scientists as a collective species? You know, or are we? Do we have one foot in, like, you know, the primitive shaman? You know, do we have one? Do we need that to achieve our humanness? Do we need to have that interaction with the mystical, with the interaction with the paranormal, in order to achieve our humanness, the same way the cat needs the chasing the stringer on the floor in order to achieve its catness? I feel like that I'm really lofty, and I apologize, but I feel that tasting, and I just feel like I've had these little flittering glimpses of bizarreness, of high strangeness, and it's expanded my outlook on the world. It seems like my definition of reality is bigger and more interesting and more collectively, colorful than it was had I have not had these experiences. There's been some drawbacks to this stuff. I mean, it feels like I'm capable of being withdrawn and self-absorbed and compulsive and, researching this stuff. But I think that, to achieve this humanness, do we require, like, our pinky toe in the paranormal?
I don't think it's a pinky toe. I think it's something that should wash over us.
Maybe, but does it wash over Joe Normal? I mean, maybe it does. Maybe everyone's having these experiences on some level and they're denying them.
Maybe so. I noticed something about myself that I don't really ever remember having any sightings of anything, really anything paranormal go on with me. I've never seen a ghost. I think I've smelled one, strangely enough. But I don't know what shut off in me that keeps me from seeing something that somebody else would see or having the experience somebody else would have. Everybody's different. And what I was saying about what you were saying about having it wash over you, I think somebody like the Dalai Lama or a really with it scientist type like maybe Michio Kaku or something like that. They've got and Dean Radin too, who I interviewed a long time ago. I think they kind of have their foot in both, and in almost in equal amounts. And thinking, the reasoning part, the scientific part is open to what the mystical part is saying to them. Carl Jung, for Christ's sake, is open to...
Richard Kepler, yeah.
Yeah, these people are open to what the mystical part is saying, but they're using their intellect to sort of attenuate it and try and figure out what's useful to them and to the species as a whole by having their foot in both, because most people don't. They've got like a tiny foot in one and the whole the pinky toe in one and the whole rest of their being and their thought in the other. And, with that, you get people like Joe Nickell on one end, and then you get people like what? I'm trying to think of somebody that's just so full of mystical stuff that they just, you can't stand them. But you know what I mean.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's the balancing act. And I think that, it might be impossible to ever get a perfect balance. But
no.
For
most people it isn't.
I think that the UFO
phenomenon
is providing modern day culture with that mysticism that we're lacking.
Yeah, and trying to come at it from a quote unquote scientific viewpoint exclusively does it a disservice. And people have written about this too and said it many times that it's maybe it's just kind of. But Bud Hopkins said this, actually. He said maybe the UFO subject is driving us, pulling us kicking and screaming into a new sort of science that won't even be called a science. It'll be called something else that might have this balance that you're mentioning here.
Yeah, and I mean, from some level, these experiences are absurd. They're so weirdly Kafkaesque and bizarre the absurdity of it is almost it stymies the forward progress in a way because for me anyway I feel like I stand here baffled I have these and my experiences presently are which I've been documenting as best I can have just been weird synchronicities lately for me. I don't have any I should be careful what I say minimal just very, very strange coincidences, very, very rich dreams that prove to be somehow resonant.
I was going to ask you about the dream because I noticed on your site that there was a lot of dream stuff recently and dream stuff from friends of yours and correspondents. And, what kind of importance do you assign to those dreams? And do you see it like a distinct or a subtle difference between them and what you think is more like a waking consciousness? Do the dreams inform your waking life?
Well, the few what I've been doing, which is this gets and I'll preface this by saying I'm stepping into to murky water here because this is hard to articulate this stuff.
Yeah.
It's super personal, and I have a dream quality that I'll refer to as a vivid dream, and it's super colorful and super intense, and I remember it really well. And these dreams are different than a normal dream. I have normal dreams have their own kind of narrative that I recognize, but I've been having these dreams that are distinctly different, and oftentimes I'll refer to them as reassuring dreams. And I've written a whole series on these dreams were reassuring in the sense that this is weird, but I've had dreams where I've had it felt like I've been on an alien white room. Obviously, to me in the dream, it's some sort of craft, and I've been experiencing telepathy. And in the dream, which it feels like a dream, I don't doubt that it's a dream. The telepathy is very, you know, like the, it feels like the radio is tuned in perfectly to the station, and the volume control is just right. So the telepathy is great. It's like, and I have this dream where it's like, you know, I'm experiencing telepathy and it's back and forth, and it's like, wow, this works perfect. And it's, you know, why should that seem weird? It's just this tidy and perfect as it can be. And I've had dreams about that, you know, like floating and interacting with hybrid aliens and things like this. Sounds so weird that I'm saying this, but and in these dreams, this is all it comes across in this very reassuring way, where it's like, well, this isn't nearly as intimidating as I thought it would be. It seems so normal. And I've been writing about those dreams, and recently the dreams that I've been doing illustrations in connection to these dreams, where you know, it's so much easier for me to draw the stuff out than it is for me to try to articulate and verbalize it.
Yeah, I like the orange lampshade.
And personally, that's just fun. That's just a neat thing. It's a neat challenge for me to try to draw this stuff that I see in such bold, weird color and such, like in these dreams that I'll draw it out. And oftentimes these dreams are very, you know, seem to be prophetic in some way.
In what way?
Or they seem, oh, go on.
In what way? In what way? In some way, is it prophetic?
Well, here, I just drew this on the blog recently, and the day before, the night before, I went to
Walter just fell over.
Which would have been, I think I figured it out, was on the 17th of February. I would have started driving the morning of the 18th, and I would have gone and I was going to pick up my friend Natasha at the airport. She was flying in from Germany, so it was all planned out. I was going to pick her up at a certain point in time, and but the night before leaving my house here, I had a crazy vivid dream, and in the dream I was in a forest, and I looked off to the side. And there was a lampshade, a glowing lampshade in the forest, and it was giving off this crazy, vivid orange color. And in the dream, in the moment, I knew that it wasn't a lampshade, and I was actually reminded of a chapter or a part of a book by Carla Turner, where she interviews, I think it was a family member, and the family member talks about seeing a satellite dish in the yard. And I thought that this is just like from that book. Now, that person saw a satellite dish, and later they found that it wasn't a satellite dish at all. And the next thing I knew, I was floating, floating upward above the forest. And I remember in the dream having this very, you know, feeling of like, you know, God damn it, like, either I can black out and not remember this, or I can, like, hold on and try to remember all this. And I remember that was a really distinct feeling. And the next thing I knew, I was hovering above a giant round shape in a forest, and I descended very smoothly, very vividly into this giant round black shape. The impression I got was that it was a giant round saucer-shaped craft, and I floated straight up above it, lined up with the middle, and then dropped straight in from the top. I'll repeat myself here and say this very much. I don't think this happened. I think this was a dream, but and then inside the craft, all of a sudden I felt like I was in a giant blue tube, and this gets very funny and dreamlike, but the colors were so intense and so vivid that it felt different, and there were these puzzle pieces, these kind of hieroglyphic puzzle pieces that were attached to the wall, and they were kind of made of clear candy-colored, primary-colored plastic, and I pulled one off, and I remember thinking to myself, I have to remember this, and it was the shape of a W. And a few more things happened, and I woke up, and I did something that I've never done before in my life. I got up, I went downstairs, I found my little digital voice recorder, which is one of those little size of a, you know, cigarette lighter, really, and I carried it back up to bed, and I climbed back up into bed, and I lay in bed, and I recorded as much as I could remember about this dream, and then I shut the light off, and this is I apologize in advance. It's going to sound a little airy-fairy. For a few seconds, I clearly saw a glowing blue orb floating above my bed. And then it just kind of slowly faded away. It didn't blink off. It didn't zip off. It just kind of stayed in motionless and kind of faded away. And I've spent so much time trying to recreate that, in the sense I've tried to figure out if it was my own. You know how you get like a little retinal burn in your eye, like you look at a flash bulb or something? And
yeah, it was the first thing I thought of.
A dot in your vision sometimes. I've been trying to do that in my bedroom, like with some light on, that I got like a little, you know, so I've been trying to you know, in essence, I don't want to believe that there was a floating blue orb in my room. Though I can't recreate it by looking at a light and then looking up at the ceiling where I saw the orb. So I'll jump forward. So I a bunch of stuff happens that feels like it's resonant with this dream, including driving through a section of forest near Sedona where I was like, this is the forest from the dream. And I got out, both Natasha and I got out of the car for a little while. I had to pee, and so did she. So we walked into the woods, and I peed, and we got back to the car, and I said, remember that dream I told you about? I think this is the forest. And then we drove on to Sedona. That doesn't mean much, but later we met this hitchhiker. We met this guy at a coffee shop. He's this eccentric fellow, and we ended up knowing a bunch of the same people, and he's a totally mystical guy, and he just produced an Oracle deck featuring crop circle photos. This is the kind of stuff I would have laughed at with contempt a few years ago, and now I'm like, great, you know, neat. What's up with your deck? Show me your deck. And so his name is Joseph Mark Cohen, and he spends some time every year, and he lives in Canada and spends some time every year in Sedona. But the weird thing was as he was there, I was like, wait a minute, he like studies the Kabbalah, and he knows all kinds of ancient Hebrew mysticism, and it's like, well, I'm going to show him this shape that I saw in the dream, this puzzle piece that I saw in this weirdly vivid dream. And so I draw this out on a napkin. We're at a restaurant, and I say, what does this mean to you? And he takes it, and it's this kind of modified W, it would be hard to describe verbally, and it's on the napkin, and he flips it over, and the W, the way it's modified, makes a JM. I ask him what this means to him, and he flips it over and says, well, it's my initials. And now that may not mean much to someone from the outside, but I found it really interesting for my own self-exploration. That, you know, I meet this hitchhiker in Sedona, and we drive to Laughlin together. He was going to go there and he was supposed to meet some folks. And then I have a dream the night before meeting him. Actually, it would have been two nights before meeting him, where I have a very vivid memory of his initials in the form of a puzzle piece. So these are the kind of experiences I'm having, which might be my own imagination, working overtime. But I don't know; it just seemed interesting to me.
Well, it doesn't sound like imagination to me. It sounds like what somebody would call a prophetic dream, and what I would call, to me, is something that, this is what, you know, remote viewers and a lot of people say, if there's something that you get like that, it has some significance to you, and you become unhooked from the time stream by that, and that kind of thing is probably inherent in the universe. That imagery for you is just there all the time, but it chose to make an appearance for you at a propitious time in our time stream, if you know what I mean. That you know I hate to use the word seeing into the future. I mean that phrase. It just brings up all kinds of horrible associations. But it's more like at a certain point, I think, when there's something that has some significance to you, especially emotionally, personally, then your mind is able to get a hold of something that's going to happen later, somewhere down the line. And who knows whether it's important or it's even worth worrying about. But it shows that, to me, I mean, the amazing part of it is it shows that time machines aren't going to, I don't think they're going to be built by people out of nuts and bolts. They're going to be something that uses your mind to be able to see these things.
Yeah, it's going to be people sitting in the, well, you know, the other extreme is it's going to be people sitting in the lotus position in a, you know, in a special reflective room or something.
Yeah, exactly. To see something far away or into the future or something that's not time and space bound so that your mind can hook onto it. The only problem is it's a lot better if you have some kind of personal connection to it, which you do in these dreams.
And they've been fun. They've been actually really fun to draw. And there's a fellow, do you know who Christopher Knowles is?
I know the name.
He runs a website called The Secret Sun. He was just interviewed on Tim Banal.
Okay, yes, I do.
He wrote that, which I thought was, he's a pretty interesting guy and does a lot of exploration into pop culture as far as mythology. But he wrote, he said, you know, I think it was at the beginning of the new year, he said, you know, keep a dream log of all your dreams and then keep a synchronicity log of all your synchronicities. And if you really give yourself over to it, those two are going to converge at some point.
That's funny. There's a lecture by William S. Burroughs, and he says exactly the same thing.
Ah, he might have stolen it from Bill Burroughs.
Well, it doesn't sound. It's a method that a lot of people have described over probably thousands of years. Shamans probably used it. Burroughs was teaching a class on creative writing. This is at the archive.org website. As part of the Naropa lectures at the Naropa Institute in Colorado.
Uh-huh.
Burroughs apparently in the 80s or early 90s gave lectures there, and one of his exercises for all these creative writers was exactly that. Keep a record of what you were thinking of or what you were doing when there was some strange connection that came up in your mind. Like you're thinking about, what he said is, I was thinking about New Mexico and suddenly I turn around a corner and there's a New Mexico license plate there. What was going on that day? What were you thinking of? What happened later? And the same thing for dreams. And I think when it's like exercising a muscle, like you're describing it. You just keep doing it, and eventually the dreaming muscle, the psychic muscle, whatever you want to call it, you're training yourself to tune in a little bit better.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when he wrote that, on his website, my first reaction was, wait a minute, I'm already doing that. And I did it. It's my blog. I was doing it on Kai. I was doing it without, like, formally saying, you know, like, I'm going to approach it this way. And since that point, I've added a few more dreams. But there's certainly dreams written about throughout the blog. And the blog is only a year old.
Yeah.
One of the things that's very interesting, and I got to figure out a way to, document this or log this or quantify this. In the act of doing this blog, I've become super aware of other folks out there that are doing very similar blogs of their own personal experiences.
Yeah.
I don't know what the right word is. I just loathe the word abductee because I don't feel like I fit that. But some people want to quantify me that way. But, you know, the people that have experienced, you know, potentially odd UFO experiences. There's a lot of people out there doing these blogs where they talk about their personal experiences. And it's super interesting because it's not going through the editing process.
Yeah.
The editing process that we described a little bit, or I described a little bit, where Bud Hopkins says, you know, oh, these things way out on the edge of the spider web, we're not going to include. You know, these people are going about it unedited and unfiltered and just, you know, kind of, you know, spilling their guts on these blogs, and it's been really interesting.
We've got 3 minutes. A listener wrote in and says, could you comment on Kent Daniel Benkowski?
Did he read my blog posting? Like, I mentioned him. This is so weird. This is like so... Okay, can I comment on him? As I was waiting for the filter ring, I was writing a blog posting on Kent Daniel Berkowski, and I actually have a audio thing. He died, and I think it was complications due to hepatitis and HIV. He died less than 2 years ago, about a year and a half ago, and he had been doing, which I thought were really fascinating, posts on secret government stuff and pop culture and movies and things like that, and a little simplistic sometimes. But he also had a UFO experience outside of Sedona that changed his life. It changed his outlook on life, and he claimed and it's, this is so weird because I was actually just about to post this before you called. And he has a very methodic and slow, soothing voice, and it's, and I find I'm almost hypnotized when I listen to him talk. And he's exactly, and I think he's a little bit older by a few months than I am. So I take a strong note of anyone that's the same age as me as I'm looking into this stuff.
Yeah. Is there anything that you want to? No. Well, there isn't really anything you want to push. Do you want to tell people again what your websites are in case they listen to this show and they want to share with you something, either publicly or not?
My email's easy to get. It's off the website. Sorry, it's off the blogs, and so you can just look at it on the blogs. The one blog is called Hidden Experience, and hiddenexperience.blogspot.com, and that's the paranormal one. And then if you want to look at some cute cartoons and see what my illustration style looks like, the other one is called Little Boing Marks, and boing, like the little boing marks are the lines on a cartoon when you show action, like someone. Moves their arm in a cartoon, and you put those little lines. Those are called boing marks, and that's littleboingmarks.blogspot.com.
Okay, great, Mike.
Yes.
This is one of the most fun interviews I've done in a while because we got to just go all over the map. And usually, when I'm talking with guests, it's about something that they've heard about, or something they've written, or somebody they've interviewed. And at this point, in this interview, we're talking to somebody that actually experiences these things, doesn't quite know what to do with them, and is really upfront and honest about it. And I really appreciate that you came on, even though we were just originally just going to talk about what happened in Laughlin. And I'm glad you agreed to do the whole 2 hours, which went like a flash.
Good. Oh, that was actually fun. This was a delight. And there's a bunch of stuff that I wanted. I sort of had some notes here that I was, about Laughlin. That I wanted to share. I have a couple really funny stories that you didn't get to hear. So
okay,
are actually very funny. So maybe I'll write. Those will be posted on the blog soon enough.
Okay. Yeah. We usually the guy comes in at 11. I mean at 10 once us out of here, but he hasn't come in a couple weeks. However, I have to, use my discretion and get out of here at 10. So yeah, please post those. Go to Mike's blogs and. Learn a bit more. Thanks again so much, Mike, and I'm sure we'll be in touch. Also, if you didn't know, I put this on UFO Mystic. Mike did the illustrations for The Cryptoterrestrials, a book that was Max Tony's last book that was released yesterday. You can order it right now off of Amazon and a few other places.
Yes, and that was quite an honor. That was a really important and moving thing for me. I just feel one of the best things ever done on this planet. Not so much the illustrations themselves, but just being involved in that project is so important.
Yeah, me too. And I didn't even know there were going to be illustrations. Now looking at them, the ones you sent to me, it's like there should be one every other page, I think. But unfortunately, you couldn't do that. But
it was funny that we kind of decided just to do chapter openers, and there was a few points where. In the text, I could do a really good illustration of this. And then it didn't really fit. So.
Yeah, well, too bad. But you could see some of that artwork. One of them is actually up on UFO Mystic that Mike sent me right before the interview. And, of course, if you order the book, too. So, maybe after the book's been out for a while, maybe you can come back on. We can talk about the specifics of the book. Although, we've both read it, so... We can talk about some of that and maybe about your drawings and what inspired you, because I love the drawings. I think that they're coming from an insider doing those drawings is much, much richer experience in that book than having just hiring some artist that doesn't know what the hell's going on. So
well, it's interesting. I'm glad you said that because I wanted to be really careful to be subtle.
Yeah.
And that's not my illustration style. My illustration style is pretty goofy and pretty cartoony, and I wanted really to be sparse. And subtle, a couple of them turned out really nice. They're going to be kind of small. I was a little, that was what's typical of me is you sit at the desk and you go, oh, and you have these tiny little itty bitty pens, and you just get like, oh, I'll just put a little shadow here and a little shadow there, and then in retrospect, it's I think they're going to be a little tiny. So.
Well, that sucks. I think you should put bigger reproductions of them up on your site.
Oh, I have. I'm planning to put a few of them up there, and I was saying I was going to wait till the book kind of came out and do it as in the hopes that it would generate a little bit of interest in the book.
I'm sure it will. Thanks again, Mike, so much for coming on, and I'll communicate with you either by phone or email very soon.
Okay, thanks, and thanks to Walter also.
Yeah, nice meeting you again.
Yeah.
Okay, Mike.
This was great.
Thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
Bye now.
Bye. That was a hell of a lot of fun. I didn't realize. I thought we were just going to do this dry thing about Laughlin, but there's such a richness in his experience. And it's funny because he's not one of these people that is either, one, I'm being abducted and having things shoved up my butt, or two, the angels are coming to save me.
Yes, being abducted with something shoved up your butt sounds like an adventure novel that I would write. What I like is he's yet another voice in the argument that I have, you know, championed, that, you know, a new kind of conference needs to emerge here, Greg. You know, the not necessarily extraterrestrial conference.
Yeah, well, the idea was to call it the non-public title for it would be the Mac Tony's Memorial UFO, right, Anomalies Conference. But to call it something else, like, you know, New Era of UFO Study Conference or something that would tell people that there's a different way to look at things, and we're going to try and present some of the best thinkers in that arena. And, you know, we've had them on the show here. You've written about them. You've talked to them. I have. And we know that, you know, unfortunately, Mac isn't around. He was probably one of the most eloquent people for that. And luckily, he did that George Norrie interview that millions of people heard before he died. And there's a few of those people around, and I would like to get exposure for them. Eloquent new thinkers who are non-dogmatic, which is a rare commodity. Radio Misterioso will be back next week, and I don't know who I'm having on next week. You never know. Sometimes I know weeks in advance, sometimes I don't. And apropos of what we were talking about, here's a song called Extrasensory Perception by Sheldon Allman from the Folk Songs for the 21st Century album, which I think came out in the late 50s sometime. Radio Misterioso, Kill Radio, thanks for listening.
We've got extrasensory perception. It makes our love unique. There isn't any doubt or question when into your mind I can peek. Not with extrasensory perception our love will grow and grow. You won't have to worry or wonder. Just look in my head and you'll know. You'll know the secrets that are in my heart. You'll know the reason and the rhyme. We'll be together when we're far apart. Baby, you'll be with me all the time. With extrasensory perception, our love will be refined. Since our affair had its inception, I can't get you out of my mind. There is no chance of a deception. How dull it's gonna be. Let's go find two normal people. Baby, stop thinking at me.
What was that you thought?